Welcome to the first episode of Baird's new IPO reboot series. I'm Tom Shadwald. I'm a director in Baird's Equity Capital Markets Group based in beautiful Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm delighted to be kicking off this IPO reboot series, which will act as a practical guide for private company executives looking to learn the ABCs of going public. The series will cover topics from pre-IPO preparation on listing alternatives all the way to what to expect once you're fully publicly listed. Today's topic will start at the beginning, so public listing alternatives. And I'm delighted to be joined by one of my go-to legal experts around the capital markets, Chris Capuzzi from Ropes & Gray. Chris, do you want to introduce yourself quickly?
Yes, Tom, I'll mention my name is Chris Capuzzi. I'm a partner in the capital markets group at Ropes & Gray, based in New York, focusing on all types of capital market transactions, IPOs, follow-on equity offerings, debt offerings, advising companies with respect to SEC reporting obligations, stock exchange matters, general corporate governance matters, with respect to companies in all types of industries, but also kind of a significant focus in specialty finance companies as well.
Thanks, Chris. So that, I think, we'll jump right into it. So as I mentioned at the top, we're going to talk about public listing alternatives as the first part in this series. The reason why we're starting here is because really the first critical step to think about when you're going public is how you do so. And so there's three real alternatives to a public listing. The first is kind of the most well-trodden initial public offering or IPO. The second is to perform a direct listing, which has become more topical in recent years, as well as the third, which is to merge with an existing public company or to merge with a SPAC, which was very common in 2020 and 2021. All three paths really have merit, and it will be situational specific, which is ultimately the right one for you to go down. So on the next slide, we'll try to discuss and pull out kind of the nuanced differences between the three paths, including all the topics you see here below. And hopefully after this session, you should have a good idea which path is best suited for your company and situation today. And so like I mentioned, while it may seem like on the surface level, the process and filings may seem pretty similar between all three alternatives to the public markets, the beauty is really in the nuanced differences. And so I'll pass it over to Chris to cover the first topic here.
Yeah, so with an IPO, you may hear people use terms like primary or secondary offering. So primary really means it's the company issuing new shares. And in an IPO, that's generally what happens. It's the company issuing new stock for a capital raise. So the company is receiving, the net proceeds from an IPO. There may be situations where it's a combination of both primary and secondary. So some existing stockholders in the IPO may be selling in that public offering. So it can either be purely primary, a combination of both, or in kind of rare situations, the IPO may just be for a purely secondary. So it's just stockholders selling, but I would think more of the norm is definitely just a pure primary or a combination of a primary with some secondary component. The direct listing is a bit different. So that's existing stock that is just getting a listing on a stock exchange so that the stock opens for trading on the stock exchange. And there is not a capital raise in connection with that. So the company is not receiving any proceeds historically to do a direct listing. I should say that the stock exchanges, there wasn't a capital raise component. It was just listing existing shares for existing shareholders. We will caveat that there is a new direct listing product with a capital raise that both the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ are rolling out. So that will allow a company in connection with the direct listing to also do a capital raise. The de-SPAC transaction, as most people probably know, that the SPAC is a company that went public and has funds held in a trust account. And that public, kind of shell company is out looking for a private target company to merge with. And by virtue of that merger, the private company thereafter becomes a public company. In that DSPAC transaction, as it's called, it can be for a combination of new or existing stock. So generally, if there's new stock, that will be as a result of a PIPE that is done alongside of the DSPAC. The target shareholders will get stock in the new go-forward public company. The founders who sponsored the SPAC will take some equity in the company. And then to the extent the public stockholders who bought in the SPAC's IPO, to the extent they don't redeem, will also, you know, continue to hold stock in that existing company. I think as most folks, you know, that are listening to this are probably aware, the SPAC shareholders do have a redemption right. So that money held in trust is also used to fund redemptions of those public SPAC stockholders at the time of the DSPAC. But so that transaction can also be for, as I said, new stock being issued to the target shareholders and to the PIPE investors, as well as existing stock for any shareholders of the SPAC who stay in and the sponsor team. And there, you know, may also be a debt raise in connection with that. That it could also be the case with an IPO. It's not noted in here, but you know, in an IPO, you also may do a debt financing in connection therewith.
Thanks, Chris. I think the kind of next important difference is kind of around the acceptable kind of sizes that the market has seen kind of across all the alternatives, because one of the primary motivations going public are typically, to some of Chris's points, to raise either new primary capital for existing shareholders to be able to sell their shares in the market, which we refer to as the secondary offering. I think in the IPO context, most companies typically list somewhere between 10 to 30% of their pro forma kind of shares outstanding. Usually for more kind of tech high growth or primary capital raises, it's towards the smaller end of that spectrum. And for larger, maybe sponsor backed secondary focused listings, carve out situations, you could be looking at the larger end of that spectrum. It's important to realize here too, or think about that kind of that first initial amount of shares that you sell in an IPO context will be your public float. And so it will determine kind of your liquidity and ultimate ability to sell down over time. Typically a follow-on offering is about 100% of the original kind of IPO size on the wide side. So I think that's an important thing to think about in an IPO context. In a direct listing, the size is really dictated by the demand level and the trading volume activity, kind of the day that you're listing. And so the exchange will essentially assemble a book of buy and sell orders the morning that they're opening the stock. And they'll look to kind of clear a first trade, and then the volume thereafter will really dictate how many shares that you can sell into the market without materially obviously driving the price down. So it's a little bit more liquidity driven and trading driven in terms of the size, and the market really is dictating that real time. And then in the DSPAC context, you see a lot of different kind of size ranges. I'd say you probably have the most flexibility in terms of the ultimate amount of capital that you want to raise, whether that's towards the smaller end of the spectrum or the larger end of the spectrum. We've seen some companies in cases raise essentially 100% of their pre-money equity value or 50% of their pro forma equity value as part of a DSPAC transaction. And then kind of hand in hand, when you think about the size, one of the other things that people typically look at when they think about these three alternatives and where they really do diverge is this concept of valuation discovery. So in an IPO context, the valuation discovery occurs over the course of the book building process. And so there'll be a range of share prices that are put on the cover of your prospectus at the time of launch. And then over the course of the roadshow, which could be anywhere from 4 to 7 days, typically, The banks and underwriters that are working on your IPO will collect orders from investors who are interested. And so they'll get various amount of shares at specific price points. And then they'll essentially do a Dutch auction style clearing pricing mechanism where the first offer price, the night your IPO prices, is essentially determined by selecting a price clearing level where there's enough demand for shares that you can sell the entire shares that you originally wanted to in your IPO. And so that's dictated by the market. There is a valuation range that's put out there initially, but it's ultimately like a Dutch auction clearing mechanism. A direct listing, the valuation discovery process, similar to kind of the capital size process, is really determined kind of the day that you're opening the stock through an auction format. So they'll also collect buy and sell orders the morning that the listing is going to occur. There's typically a reference price that is put out that morning before the book build process begins by the exchanges themselves. And then they look to build kind of buys and sells around that reference price or above it. Ultimately, if the kind of order matching doesn't come up to the reference price that you initially wanted, you can ultimately delay the listing. But typically, you have a pretty good sense of demand that morning when you're trying to open the stock. In a de-SPAC transaction or a reverse merger into a kind of a public shell, it's really totally different. It's a much more M&A negotiation. So you'll actually negotiate with the owner of the public shell. I think when you think about the price discovery here, you don't have to negotiate with just one SPAC or one public shell. You can negotiate with many at the same time, similar to kind of a sell side M&A process, and ultimately kind of determine the clearing market in negotiation with the SPAC or the public shell.
Yeah, and the way I kind of like also think about that, especially between the IPO versus the de-SPAC. So the de-SPAC, it's like you're coming to your valuation number as a part of a negotiation between the buyer and the seller, and then backing into the number of shares, because the shares in the de-SPAC are always valued at or priced at $10 a share. So you kind of back into your capitalization from the valuation number, whereas in the IPO, it's kind of the reverse. You're discovering the per share price and then, you know, multiplying that by the float to, or the number of shares that you're offering to get your pro forma valuation.
Yeah, that's a great point, Chris.
Next, we'll talk a little bit about the marketing processes for the three of them. So in an IPO, what folks will start doing once they're ready to kind of start telling the story of the company is what's called testing the waters. And that's done while your S-1, which is the registration statement for an IPO, has been confidentially submitted or is not publicly filed with the SEC. So during testing the waters, you're not taking orders. It's really kind of educating the buy side about the company, kind of testing demand, price, valuation. Once your S-1 is on file and you need to publicly file the S-1 15 days before you begin your roadshow, the public roadshow is really like the actual marketing of the deal. So that's when, as Tom said, once you go out with a preliminary prospectus that has a price range on it. And during that public roadshow, you know, the deck and the materials that are used in the public roadshow are pretty similar to what was shown in the testing the waters. But during the public roadshow, that's where you're really, you know, taking orders or trying to build a book. And then on the pricing day, you know, when that's where the Dutch auction comes in that Tom was talking about, that's where you then, you know, establish the price to the public as it's kind of the culmination of that roadshow. Testing the waters can go on for, you know, it can be really short depending on the type of company. In other companies, it goes on for, you know, several weeks or a couple months, or you may go back out and test the waters again a second time to the extent, you know, the market changes or the story of the company changes. The public roadshow, you know, is anywhere from 4 to 7 days, and in some unique circumstances, you might go 2 weeks. But you really, you know, folks don't really like to hold an order book over the course of a weekend. So it's often, you know, less than 7 or 5 days. In the direct listing, because, you know, you're not building an order book of buy orders, but you're really just kind of establishing that market clearing price on the day that you open. You do investor education days where you're, you know, again, just telling the story of the company, but it's, you know, somewhat price discovery, but you're not building an order book really in the way that you are in an IPO. In a de-SPAC, it's somewhat similar to an IPO. So often how it starts is it's in connection with kind of the PIPE process. So the PIPE is a private equity raise done by the SPAC, and they'll try and raise that equity or get commitments for that equity raise prior to publicly announcing the de-SPAC transaction. So in order to conduct that process, because the SPAC is a publicly traded company already, you need to wall cross those investors that you're talking to so that those wall crossed investors, you know, will get information about the target company, but they're getting that information before that information has been publicly disclosed. And so they can't trade on the basis of that information because it would be MNPI, material non-public information. So you wall cross those investors, kind of do a testing the waters type process with those investors. You know, you're not looking to establish a price per share, but you are talking to them about the valuation of the company, the valuation discovery, and, you know, trying to get them to commit to investing in a PIPE. To the extent there isn't a PIPE raise, you know, banks may still, the banks that are working with the SPAC and the target companies may still do a wall cross process, really just to kind of establish investor demand and appetite and tell the story. And then once that deal is announced, once that merger agreement is signed and the deal is publicly announced by the SPAC, you know, the presentation that was used in that wall cross will be publicly filed to cleanse those investors of the MNPI that they had. And then that presentation will kind of continue to be used throughout the whole process. And that when I say process, that's the SPAC's registration process with the SEC, which is on Form S-4, generally on Form S-4, or a tender offer, depending on the situation. But that during the time that your registration statement is being reviewed by the SEC and going through, you know, rounds of comments with the SEC, there will continue to be kind of an extended public roadshow where you're continuing to educate the market, the buy side market, on the story of the company going forward. On timing for the three different processes, so the IPO process, you know, it can take anywhere, depending on the type of company. Like, there are some companies that you might be working in an IPO for a year plus, but I would say on average, you know, you're looking 6 months or so, 4 to 5 of them are generally where your registration statement is still private. You know, you're not going to file the registration statement right away. It's at some point in those 4 to 5 months, but leading up to file confidentially submitting your draft registration statement, you're doing drafting sessions, like meetings with the company. Then you file that draft registration statement, go through rounds of SEC comments, and then really flip public once you're ready to kind of let the public know that this deal is coming and you're going to, you know, launch your offering. The direct listing is the same type of process. You can confidentially submit your S-1 registration statement, and then it just needs to be publicly filed 15 days before you're looking to go effective, which would be the day that you're opening trading.
Chris, the thing I'd say kind of about from a timing perspective of those first two alternatives, which is important, is that the speed in which you get from basically day one of starting your IPO preparation process to when you're actually meeting with investors is probably more extended than in the de-SPAC context, which you're probably getting to investors a little bit more quickly, given that the private phase is shorter than the public phase. The reason for that is really that in the private context, market practice is typically that you draft the registration statement, get the initial one on file confidentially, and then you kick off the testing the waters process, which is slightly different in the DSPAC context.
Yeah, that's a totally good point. So in the IPO and direct listing, those first couple months where you're private, like you're not out testing the waters or really talking to investors. It's just the company and the bankers and their lawyers working on that registration statement and any kind of corporate restructuring that might need to be done in connection with the IPO. Whereas on the DSPAC side, you're private pretty quickly. The private side really is only whilst, you know, the company, the SPAC is negotiating the merger agreement with the target company. And they'll look to announce that deal, you know, pretty quickly once a merger agreement is signed. And so then once the deal is publicly announced, there's usually a little bit of lead time before the SPAC files its S-4 and then kind of goes through the SEC's process on the DSPAC. But to Tom's point, he's absolutely correct that the private process on the DSPAC is a lot more compressed, and you're out telling the story pretty much right away. You know, once the SPAC is really negotiating a BCA with that target company, like you're already out there telling the story with the wall-crossed investors. Unlike in the IPO and the direct listing, you're really not doing testing the waters until you're pretty far along in your process with the SEC and close to having, you know, a market window where you're looking to, you know, do the IPO. On costs, so costs are going to be there's going to be overlapping costs that are going to be the same in each. So you'll have, you know, legal fees, accounting fees, SEC registration fees, printer fees, you know, to do the printer to do the public filings and print a prospectus, and kind of other deal related expenses. The way that the banks make money in the IPO is as an underwriting spread, which is a percentage of the gross proceeds raised in the offering. So, you know, the gross price to the public, the banks retain a portion of that, and then the company takes the net proceeds. In an IPO, you know, it can be anywhere from 3.5% to 7%. I would think, Tom, correct me if you think that's wrong, but I would think 5% to 7% is what you're most likely going to see in an IPO. On a direct listing, there is no underwriting. You know, the banks aren't buying shares and then turning around and selling them to the public. So there's not a spread to take. So it's really just an advisory fee that the financial advisor, the bank acting as a financial advisor, would take. And in the DSPAC, it can be a combination of both. You know, if you're doing a PIPE, for example, the fee will be a percentage of the proceeds raised in the PIPE, but then, you know, to the extent banks are also acting as capital markets advisors or financial advisors, they'll be taking, you know, an underwriting fee for those roles as opposed to kind of a percentage of equity raised.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, which we don't list here on purpose, I think people think about it differently. But inherent in all three of these options is going to be the concept of the quote unquote IPO discount, where investors essentially are all going to have a different view of who the existing public comps are, and what valuations they're trading at on a forward basis. And they're going to expect that the listing in any of these three cases, the initial kind of valuation price that it clears at is going to be a discount. The reason for that is that the public investors essentially are buying a stock for the first time that doesn't obviously have a year's worth of quarterly filings. And they're going to want some discount built in there to just kind of protect their downside. But I think a lot of people, when they talk about these, they may reference being able to kind of close that discount more narrowly, but ultimately, I think in practice, it's pretty difficult to escape in any of the three alternatives.
Yeah.
And so when you think about kind of like post-listing, so you're already, you've priced the IPO or you've done the direct listing or you closed your de-SPAC. Now you're a listed public company. How does it differ across the kind of three alternatives in terms of what the impacts would be based on which option you picked? And so in both an IPO and de-SPAC context, typically investors prior to the initial listing have this 180-day lockup period. We've seen that be shorter in times where the market is more robust and accepting of new listings. But historically, if you look at it, it's probably 95 or 99% of all kind of IPOs, public listings have this concept of the 180-day lockup. And that's really so that the stock after listing can trade naturally and find kind of this market clearing price before additional shares are allowed to be sold into the float. The direct listing is kind of the one alternative where there really isn't this lockup period, which is one of the reasons why the direct listing is a path that some companies take who are focused on getting liquidity for existing shareholders as one of the main reasons for wanting to go public, because you do have much more liquidity immediately upon kind of that listing period. I think one of the other really important differences here, and it's why we put most support under IPO here on the left, is that an IPO has this concept of what's called a green shoe, which in kind of technical trading terms is really a covered short position. And what that allows your underwriting banks to do is essentially they sell more shares than your base deal in the IPO. So they establish a short at the IPO pricing of typically 15% of the offering size. And then if the stock trades down in the aftermarket, the stabilization bank or usually the lead underwriter in your IPO can go into the market and essentially buy those, buy shares to support the price. And if they go into the market and buy shares to support the price, then essentially those additional shares that were sold out in the IPO to lay out the short position will essentially cease to exist and will just close out the short position. If they don't need to stabilize the stock in the aftermarket, then it's essentially we exercise the green shoe, it's called, and you deliver those additional 15% in proceeds to the company net of the gross spread. I think in a direct listing and a de-SPAC context, there is really no ability to establish that kind of green shoe position. And so when it comes to kind of the aftermarket support, you're kind of thinking about things like how many banks and investors and equity research, sales and trading folks are really invested in your story and talking about your story. And so I think in a de-SPAC context, historically, there's been more kind of banks involved throughout the process. Usually it's a couple prior to the public announcement, and then more will get involved between the public announcement and the closing process. In a direct listing, initially, when some of these were happening a couple of years ago, there were kind of less banks involved from a financial advisory perspective. I'd say that's kind of broadened out as the product continues to kind of mature. And so I think when you think about kind of post-listing support and having eyeballs and people talking about your stock, the IPO probably gets the most on there just due to how the process itself works. And the direct listing and the de-SPAC are probably pretty similar in terms of not necessarily having that broad-based support kind of day one post-listing. And so hopefully that was insightful for all of you and highlighted a lot of differences. So just to put it in context, to put it in the conclusion, Chris, maybe you can kick us off here.
Yeah, so an IPO is pretty good for companies that have an equity story that is well understood by the market, kind of, you know, easy to tell because you're doing a relatively short marketing period. It's good for a company looking to raise a reasonable amount of capital relative to the market cap and not, you know, put all of it, its capitalization into the IPO or flood the market with all of its shares. You still, you know, investors with skin in the game. And it creates liquidity for those existing shareholders that can materialize over time. So to the extent you have large, you know, VCs or private equity owners that were in the company, like they can continue to get liquidity in the future after the IPO by selling their shares in secondary offerings.
Yeah, and so looking at the direct listing alternative, it's typically best for companies with a very well-known name brand. As I mentioned, it really is dependent on the day that the stock is opening. And so if you're a well-known consumer brand or similar along those lines, you're going to have a lot of not only institutional interest, but a lot of retail interest. So stories like that work really well because people want to buy the brands that they love, including their stocks. If you want to focus on kind of getting as much liquidity for existing shareholders kind of day one, because they're not necessarily subject to the lockup restrictions under the other alternatives. And the last kind of point is around kind of just the marketing process in general. Like I said, big company or well-known name brand or something that doesn't require a syndicate of a bunch of banks to get the story out there. The story can kind of get out there naturally. That's typically kind of one of the reasons why a direct listing would be kind of a good alternative to think about and a viable option.
And the de-SPAC is good where the parties want flexibility in structuring, you know, and also probably expeditiousness. People will say that a de-SPAC can be done faster than an IPO. It's done publicly. There's a longer public period. So to the extent the story is complex or, you know, if the company might be kind of pre-revenue or still developing, like it will benefit from that longer period of investor education while your S4 is on file and you're continuing to go out and publicly marketing and telling the story of that company. And it also is good because, as we said earlier on, there's upfront price discovery. The valuation of the company was established as part of a merger process as opposed to as part of a marketing process.
Thanks, Chris. I think we'll stop it there for today. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to Chris or myself or any of your Baird and Ropes and Gray representatives. It's been a pleasure hosting today's session, and we look forward to future episodes of the series here. And just a teaser, if you made it this far, next week we plan to dive in to the key items you should think about from a preparation standpoint for a public listing. So thanks again for joining. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Tom. Bye.
Thank you, Chris.